This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have with us now to talk about the stories that she has in print and online this week. We have Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune. Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me today.
Well, you've got some great stories, and we'll start out with one of the good ones. A lot of these, of course, have to deal with the city of Gary, of course, and this one in particular. There have been a lot of complaints, I'm sure, over the years about, and after the great downtown hub that used to be in the city of Gary after it started to decay with the loss of Sears and Penney's and Goldblatt's and the Kresge stores. City of Gary decided very recently here and started work this week on some big demolition projects. Tell us about them.
They did. This is the Gary Housing Authority that is signed off on this demolition because they own the buildings. That came about through a land swap with the city of Gary, and that swap included property that the GHA owned called the Ivanhoe Gardens that was a former public housing project on 15th Avenue on the city's west side, and all of those buildings there were razed, and that property is now shovel-ready. And in exchange, the GHA got the buildings along Broadway. The demolition that's going on now includes about 14 buildings, I guess, and they're in the 500 to 700 block of Broadway. Costs nearly $1 million, I'm told.
I've seen some old pictures of how that area, that 500 to 700 block of Broadway, looked back in the day, and it was very, very, very impressive when you saw all those stores and all the activity there in downtown Gary at the time. So I'm sure it's quite a shock to many people now that there's nothing there.
If you grew up there, or if you're like me, parents would occasionally drag me down there back mm-hmm. when it was maybe toward the end of its heyday, but still bustling a little bit. You remember stores like Penny's and Sears, and my mom's personal favorite was called Goldblatt's.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the hub of commerce for Northwest Indiana, really. And in the following the election of Richard Hatcher and an expansion into Merrillville with the construction of South Lake Mall, you know, signaling that national shift from downtown hubs to shopping malls, Gary lost much of that commerce to the malls, and those buildings stood vacant for the most part, fell victims to blight and unsightliness, and you know, just one other evidence of the despair that some of the residents left behind were facing every day.
Well, I realize, too, that there's probably certainly beyond the fact that there are many residents that that certainly have decried the decay of downtown Gary in that particular area. But there's one artist, Felix Maldonado, who, if he knows about it now, or if his family members know about it now, they're probably upset because Felix's big mural of the Jackson 5 used to be there, but it isn't any longer.
Yeah, he won a contest that the city held in 2016, and they were looking for artists to do murals on some of the vacant buildings to kind of change the landscape a little bit and bring some color and artwork to these buildings. And his building was at 575 Broadway. I believe it used to be the Gary First Bank One, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
That building was empty and huge side of the building, and he put up this beautiful Jackson 5 spray-painted mural that kind of became a big landmark for people whenever they drive down Broadway.
Now, what are the plans as far as the city is concerned or the GHA is concerned, although it may not be any of their buildings, to do any more demolition on Broadway? Are there any other sites in the works that are being looked at that you know of?
I think this is the extent of the demolition because it's the extent of the property that they own.
Mm-hmm.
What I was told by the director, Julian Marsh, is they plan to, as soon as the buildings are gone, they'll be graded and grass seed will be planted, and there will be a park-like look to those buildings. Then they are getting ready to offer the property for purchase for developers, for whoever is interested, and they will work with the city's redevelopment commission to vet new interested developers.
Do you know if there was any historic value to any of these? Obviously, they were in pretty sad shape and certainly ripe for demolition, but were there any efforts or thoughts of trying to preserve any because of the historic landmark value they may have?
I was told the entire Broadway corridor there is considered a historic district.
Uh-huh.
And so all of the buildings really would be. But the state... the state has a historical and cultural committee as part of the Department of Natural Resources, and they inspected these buildings and really deemed them too far gone to be worth preserving. So they approved the demolition, and the Gary Historical and Cultural Committee approved it, and Indiana Landmarks did as well.
So. Well, I guess all we can do is hope that the city of Gary can find some nice tenants to take over the space, even though it'll get turned into green space temporarily. It'll be something for planning for the future.
Yeah, Julian Marsh did indicate that he has at least one developer interested in one of the vacant lots, so we'll see what happens.
That's good. That's good. One of the other stories that you had in print and online out there from the city of Gary, of course, follows through with the actions of the 2020 election here in Northwest Indiana, and that is the very important Gary Community School Corporation referendum that voters apparently were in favor of this time around.
Yeah, they passed it by about, 60% of the folks who voted endorsed the referendum. It's 72.1 million over 8 years. And they had promised, as part of the referendum, teachers a raise for teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't seen a raise in close to a dozen years, and that actually was followed through this morning. They're going to get a 5.3% raise.
That's good news for everybody. That's and not only the teachers and the administration for the Gary Schools, because they wanted to be able to. First off, they had the referendum for all the other things that they were planning to do, but certainly to be able to give the teachers the long overdue raise. Again, remind us what the referendum has actually going to do. Now that it's been approved by voters, there's going to be some money that's going to be set aside from property taxes, I understand.
Yeah, it's considered an operating referendum, so it will bolster the bottom line of the school district. They'll get close to $9 million every year of the eight-year referendum, and they'll use it to pay bills, to pay down the debt, and to make certain academic and athletic enhancements, at least that's what we're being told, such as there is a new track going in at Westside High School. Those kids haven't had a track in several years. They've had all of their track meets have been away. So finally, by the springtime, they'll get a new track. The roof is going to be replaced at Westside, and other academic enhancements include more social workers in the schools to help students, hopefully once they can get back into the schools, because
yeah.
They're still out and look to be out probably until next year at this point. So. They have a whole host of things that they're planning, and they've also pledged to ease the doubts of the skeptics to have a referendum committee that is going to keep track of where the money's going and hold public meetings to establish a level of accountability on how the money's being spent.
Yeah, I understand that they even before the referendum was actually on the ballot, at least before voters on election day, that the Gary Community School Corporation wanted to be sure that at least the framework was set up for this advisory committee, or the oversight committee, I guess is what it's called.
Right, right. They did a good job in their campaign this time around. This was the third time Gary's tried for a referendum. And this time they established a coalition with the Baptist Ministers Association and with teachers and with the community and with some key lawmakers, Vernon Smith and Eddie Melton. And there was a constant radio presence and social media presence, and because of the pandemic, there were virtual forums, and the word got out, and they they made their message known, and apparently it resonated with voters.
In fact, we had the school district's manager, Dr. Paige McNulty, on Regionally Speaking a couple times before Election Day to talk about it and let people know details as much as we can get fit in 15 or so minutes. It seemed to at least be our part to be able to get the word out. One of the other stories that you have out there that's available to take a look at, either on the Post Tribune website or my hard print, if you want to call it that, is the latest news that's come out concerning the school district in Gary about the pandemic and the impact that all of these extra cases that have come up here in the hospitals and the like of dealing with has turned, I guess, into changing some of the instruction now, for at least for a while.
Well, Gary has remained started the year with remote learning, and it was announced this week that teachers, and like many of the district teachers, have been doing that remote learning from their classrooms at their schools for 3 days a week. And because of the increase in cases, McNulty cited, I think, 9 teachers who either tested positive or were in quarantine, as well as some central office people as well. It's become difficult for the district to continue to operate with sending the teachers into schools every day. They're more comfortable keeping them at home and extending the remote learning that way to reduce the possibility of future infections. So they will start the next year, 2021, remotely for now. And they are, like all other school districts, are keeping an eye on the infection rate and hoping that it goes down. And when that happens, they'll feel more comfortable about in-person learning again.
So we'll know, I guess, on Monday how the changeover is going to do, I guess. They've had some success, though, I imagine, through the start of the school year, we should say, with remote learning. But I guess they were hoping that they wouldn't have to do it all year long.
Certainly. I'm sure nobody wants to go in that direction. And as we sit here, we watch several districts, Munster, Portage, River Forest, Crown Point, Valparaiso, they all tried to do the in-learning experiment, I guess. And because of the rise in infections, they're falling back to virtual learning again.
One of the other stories that you had in print online as well, too, Carol, which we'd like to hear more about, is about the case involving Gary City Councilman Ron Brewer. He got into trouble with the law, and it may turn out that he may get the charges against him dropped. Fill us in, first off, what got Ron Brewer involved with the authorities at the first place, and also, too, what the special agreement that may be worked out with the prosecutor's office has to do.
Yeah, it happened last year. It stemmed from an incident at a Gary gas station. Brewer went inside to pay, and when he did so, he looked up and saw that some teenagers had jumped inside his car, and they were driving away with it. And he decided to, I guess, follow the car as best he could. He had some kind of a tracking device that enabled him to follow his own car, and followed the teenagers to East Chicago. And he was talking with Gary police along the way. And he was accused of and charged with 3 felony counts of intimidation, kidnapping, and criminal confinement, I believe the other one was. And East Chicago police brought the charges to the Lake County prosecutor. And it's been over a year now, and there's been some negotiations, and Brewer has resisted calls to resign. He's remained on the city council and said that he was trying to effect a citizen's arrest, and that was his defense primarily. He hasn't really spoken much publicly about it. And on, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, the prosecutor's office did agree to drop the charges. He'll have a misdemeanor charge remaining, and he needs to stay clean, basically, for 6 months. It's called a pretrial diversion program. And if he does that, in May, there will be a hearing and they will drop the charges. If he had been convicted of a felony count, he would have lost his position on the city council.
Well, that's sometimes it's better that way. If the charge is serious enough that he's can show that he's contrite and was sorry that he did what he did or whatever that may be, that it's a way to resolve the matter and try and make it satisfactory for everybody involved, I would imagine.
We'll
find out.
Heading in now.
We'll find out, to be sure. Well, Carol, thank you for spending time with us, going over the stories that you had in print and online this week here and in recent weeks in the Post Tribune. And we will have you back again soon, we hope.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome. Carol Carlson's a reporter for the Post Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In recent weeks, there have been a series of virtual solution table conversations with local and statewide elected officials and law enforcement officers and members of a community here involving the city of Gary and the faith leaders and community partnerships, as the group is called. And they've had one of these recent meetings just yesterday. Let's find out a bit more about it. Burgess Peoples is the president and chief strategist for the organization of faith leaders and community partnerships. It's working with Mayor Jerome's office on this project, and she is with us to talk about things. Good morning. How are you? And thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Good morning, Chris, and thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first off what the organization's goals are and how these conversations seem to be fitting in with it.
Well, the goals are for us to be resources for families, businesses affected by critical changes in our world, of course, but also to send clear messages to what we want. Like right now. And so with the panel discussions, it tied in to our mission, and that is to be a voice, to be present, and to offer solutions throughout our region and get everybody involved. Like, listen, you live here too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we want to talk at you, we want to talk with you so we can come up with solutions that's going to be for the betterment of all mankind.
Now, one of the topics that's come up here just recently is, of course, been the concern about partnership with the community and with law enforcement and in the city of Gary in particular. What are some of the other topics in the past discussions been about and who have been involved in them as panelists?
The past discussions have been on poverty during COVID, police reform, and systemic racism. Past Senator Eddie Melton was one of the panelists, and of course, Mayor Jerome Prince, City of Gary. And we've had several faith leaders, the president of the Gary and Vicinity Baptist Ministers, the president of the interfaith clergy, Gary and Vicinity, that the president of the Baptist Ministers is Pastor Corey Jackson, and the interfaith is Pastor Dr. David Neville. And along with a slew of other individuals, also with town council, fourth ward, Steve Tolowitzki, and like I said, a lot of other individuals. And the conversations have been stringent. I mean, they come to the table wide open to learn, to hear what the public need and what they have to say. And when they give their input, it is coming from the heart. And that is what the public need, along with information on how we can assist our legislative body in pushing in new bills and policies to help us further make the necessary changes so we can feel safe.
Now, I understand that many of these participants have been in each one of the conversations, but you had a special one in the one that was held yesterday. You actually got the superintendent of the Indiana State Police to participate. Tell us how Superintendent Doug Carter was involved in this, and I understand he actually came to town, so to speak, for
yes.
this event. And I guess we got set up, I guess, in an unusual place to hold a meeting.
Yes. Well, yesterday was Veterans Day, and of course we salute all of our veterans. I have been in conversations with Superintendent of the State Police, Doug Carter, for about a couple of weeks. And what he said was, hey, listen, I heard about you through one of your mutual friend, Janae Nguyen from the Indiana Parenting Institute. And he was like, I am absolutely loving the solution tables, and I want to be a part this is close to his heart, and he's like, I want to be a part of this. I want to be a change agent as well. And he showed his commitment and dedication to this. He flew in yesterday to the city of Gary. Myself and the director of communications for the city of Gary, Michael Gonzalez, we were having breakfast at Jay's Breakfast Club, and we were going to tune in from there. So he came in, and he's like, hey, I'm here. It just blew my mind to see that kind of dedication, not just at the local level, but from the state level. And he gave some very, very insightful information regarding where we are in policing and how he wanted to see things move forward differently and how to impact these type of things by having these sort of conversations, raw conversations, whereas, hey, you just tell the truth and then let it all, you know, out, and let's see what we can take it from there. But his input and just having him here in the city of Gary was absolutely outstanding.
I understand you had some good comments and discussion that came from some of the other members that was on yesterday's panel as well, including the town councilman from Munster.
I love what Councilman Steve had to say about breaking the silence. His input on that was, it just gave me chills, because a lot of times we can be in a room, white, black, it does not matter, and hear people say and or do things that can impact a relationship, but impact a region and a community negatively if we stay silent. So his that one sentence about silence is dangerous, basically, I'm paraphrasing, but to open up our mouths and start speaking about what we really want, I think is more impactful than sitting back in a corner and not saying anything about change.
Yeah. I understand that Gary Police Chief Brian Evans has been a participant. It was in yesterday's discussion. Has he been a participant in all of these table conversations that have been held since July?
Not all of them, but he has truly been impactful. He has. We had a peace rally before we kicked off the discussions, and he was there and speaking and talking and taking in information with our meetings with the mayor. Of course, he has given some great insight on what policing looks like right here in the city of Gary and how they want to partner with the community, having community policing together, just talking. Like, you know, this really doesn't work. And I think it was Pastor Corey Jackson that said about how we used to have Officer Friendly. When I grew up, I knew Officer Friendly in my community. And we have police officers in my family, so I know all police officers are not bad. And to change the narrative and perspective from our youth today, I would say bring back those type of characters in the community. The regular police, letting us know your first name, inviting them for, you know, a cup of coffee to say, you know, we support you and we are behind you. We just do not care for the bad policing. And how do we come together on that? So Chief of Police Brian Evans was very, very clear about wanting to do that, wanting to partner, wanting to hear the voices of the community and also to be heard. So it will not be a one-sided conversation and one-sided action, but we can do this together.
Now, are there any more conversations coming up beyond the one that was held yesterday, and any particular topics you hope to bring up at those?
Yes, there's one coming up in January. We are ironing out all the details right now. We'll be working with our legislative body in the State House and waiting for them to bring back policies, laws, and bills that we all can look at and say, hey, listen, this really will work, or can you guys put this in here that may not work for us? But collectively, we're coming together and making these decisions and supporting what our legislative body bring to the floor in the State House. So in January, our conversation is still going to be on police reform and moving forward with that. I know that we can, there's a slew of things everyone wants to have happen, but it's not going to happen all at one time.
Right.
So I figure if we can focus on this one area and have an accomplishment here, everything else will fall into place. The biggest question yesterday was about racism, and do we honestly believe we can eradicate it? And every panelist had the same notion of saying no. My thing is, you're right, we may not be able to eradicate this thing, but individually we can make a choice to change the way we treat one another, how we communicate with one another, and how we interact with one another in this space on Earth.
Burgess Peoples is the president and chief strategist for an organization called the City of Gary Faith Leaders and Community Partnerships. And Burgess, thank you for being with us and passing on this information about this latest series of discussions. And we hope to find out more later in January after the next one. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Hoosier Environmental Council is one of 10 organizations around the country that have filed a federal court lawsuit in Washington, D.C. recently against the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency about the issue of whether industrial flares at the petrochemical plants and other such facilities should be cleaned up, and that is to say to put some tougher rules in place. Let's find out more. We have Jesse Carbonda, who's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, with us to talk about it and other things, too. And Jesse, thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us more about the lawsuit that the HEC is a party to now. And I guess in general, we think about flares. We see them every day if we're here in Northwest Indiana in particular, but kind of forget about them. But they are important to keep in mind.
That's right. I mean, I think it's one of the elements of the air pollution control problem in America that we haven't fully had a handle on. And the reason is kind of simple. And that is that the standards related to these flares haven't been updated in 2 to 3 decades.
Mm-hmm.
And it pertains to a whole array of different industrial sectors. So people who are living downwind from these facilities could be subject to very toxic pollutants. Why is that the case? Because, again, these standards haven't been updated in decades. And so the problem is that you've got a flare stack. It is, in theory, supposed to burn off pretty toxic gases like hazardous air pollutants or volatile organic compounds. But what can happen is if the flare stack is either poorly designed or is poorly operated, then it could lead to a portion of the stream of gas that comes out of these stacks not being properly burned.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're talking about sometimes carcinogenic chemicals coming out of these flare stacks.
Now, you mentioned the EPA has a series of air pollution control standards, which are very old. 25, 26 in one case and 34 years in the other. What are these standards supposed to really protect against, just basically the overall pollution that comes about, or are they very specific?
Well, these standards are specific to flare stacks.
Okay.
So flare stacks are used in situations where a factory, whether that's a petrochemical facility or a chemical facility or maybe something involved in the oil and gas industry like a oil well or gas well or pipe or compressor station or bulk storage facility.
Mm-hmm.
In any of those cases, there are going to be scenarios where you're going to have to stop the plant. Maybe it's because of maintenance. Maybe it's because of an emergency. In those circumstances, you're going to potentially have dangerous gases that you'll want to emit. But in theory, you'll want to emit them in ways that, again, you fully burn it off. But the problem is that the way these are designed and sometimes the way these are operated, you're not fully burning it off.
Mm-hmm. Now, here in Northwest Indiana, we know for sure that there are flares. You just have to go up to the BP refinery in Whiting to see them. And I suppose even around Indianapolis that there are similar types of industrial flares that can cause the same kind of problems, too, for folks that live downwind from them.
Absolutely, Chris. You know, the striking thing about it in our partnership with the Environmental Integrity Project, which is our attorney in this lawsuit, is how prevalent this challenge is across Indiana. I mean, we're talking about certain types of landfills, fertilizer plants, and as I mentioned, petrochemical and chemical facilities. So certainly we have identified facilities in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte County that would be subject to these flare standards that, again, have been woefully lacking an update in the 25 to 35-year range.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any reason that you all have gotten from the EPA about why these standards haven't been updated?
The best we can discern is that they feel that the standards are adequate. But once again, the EPA had done a study on a particular subsector of the array of sectors that are subject to these flare standards. And their own study, the EPA's own study, showed that the efficiency of some of these flares was at 92% rather than 98%.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about, potentially 4 to 5 times more toxic gases being emitted than ought to be the case by design.
Now, this lawsuit was filed in federal court in Washington late last month, and I understand this is not the first time that the EPA has been warned that they're liable to be sued over this.
That's right. We gave them a notice back in June, and our hope was for a kind of an amicable response, which is to say, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention, and yes, we will commit ourselves to modernizing these two different types of flare standards that haven't been updated since 1986 and 1994, but that was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as you said, last month we did end up suing the EPA, the Trump EPA.
Now, we know that these federal lawsuits, especially over something involving the EPA, are not quick in resolution. They get stretched out. But I do know that the Hoosier Environmental Council is very much involved in another event, which is a lot sooner and will happen a lot faster. And we're talking in this case about the fact that the Indiana General Assembly will be back in session in January for a new session and a number of new members. And Greening the State House is the big HEC event that you folks put on to school these folks.
That's right, Chris. Greening the State House is going to be held on Friday, November the 20th, and Saturday, November the 21st. And this has historically been the largest gathering of environmental-minded Hoosiers from across the state. Historically, of course, it's been held at a single place, but this time it's going to be a virtual conference.
Mm-hmm.
So we very much hope that there will be a great contingent from Northwest Indiana. This year, we will have a number of lawmakers as speakers, both Republicans and Democrats, and that's very important because both of them will have a very kind of an interesting story to tell. The Republicans will talk about, how do you navigate supermajorities. In fact, the supermajorities are even greater in the Indiana House of Representatives than they were in the last few cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Democrats will say, "Well, how do Democrats be effective in this context?" And their answer will probably be focused on amendments. And Chris, we're going to have dedicated panel conversations on lake and river quality. Of course, very important to Northwest Indiana. Environmental justice, once again, very important to Northwest Indiana, given the cluster of industry there and the way that can impact low income and communities of color. We're going to have panel discussions on energy. Clean energy, as well as on wildlife habitat protection.
Do we have any folks from Northwest Indiana, lawmakers and other participants in the event coming up this year?
We're hoping that Representative Carol Jackson,
mm-hmm.
who was the leader, as you may recall, in a bill that requires lead testing in schools, we're hoping that she can be a panelist on our environmental justice panel.
That's great. Great to hear. Now, if anybody would be interested in perhaps if not necessarily participating, although they can, but certainly observing all that's going to be happening for Greening the State House coming up here November 20th and 21st, how can they do so?
They would go to hecweb.org/GTS, and we have general admission tickets as well as student tickets. And once again, it's a virtual platform. There are several different panel discussions. We're doing it on the 20th as well as the 21st because we want to be as accommodating and understanding of the very diverse schedules people have where they're balancing working remotely often or balancing childcare with work and so forth. So we're hoping it will be as convenient as possible.
Jesse Carpanda is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Thank you for being with us and telling us about the big event coming up and also, too, about the lawsuit that the HEC is participating in involving industrial flares around the country, in particular here in Indiana. Thanks for being with us.
Really glad to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
And as postscript to the conversation, we should also mention that Greening the State House coming up will also include a dedicated breakout session where citizens who are listening in or watching can get involved and pick up some advocacy skills, like how to get in contact with your state lawmaker or how to be able to take care of other matters and stay in touch with lawmakers at the State House during the session to find out how they're doing on these measures that are coming up involving the environment. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Parenting Institute's COO is Janae Beleza, and she is with us to talk about a couple events, one which is coming up very soon here in Northwest Indiana, and another that you may or you may know of somebody who is interested in participating in. Janae, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. It is always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, bring us up to date on the annual State of the Family Luncheon, which is coming up on November 16th here in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, it is, gratefully, because with COVID, we were not sure. But virtual events actually can be a very pleasurable experience. And so having done a couple, we decided we could do this virtually. So basically what the we call it the SOFL because we like to acronym everything over here. But what the State of the Family Luncheon is about is it's really an opportunity to get folks who work with families especially, but also, you know, stakeholders, thought leaders, just in a room to talk about what is the state of our family here in Northwest Indiana? What's going on with trends? What's going on with discoveries? What's going on with new methods to address situations? And how do we take all of that data, put it together in a way that's useful for the community? And so that's what this is about. So we bring in experts from a variety of fields. Well, we bring in the expert as a keynote to kind of give a general look at what the state of the family is. And then we bring in experts from the areas of education, health, and welfare to talk on those three areas as it impacts families. And so to give you who we've got this year, our keynote is Jerry Milner, who is the Associate Commissioner for the U.S. Children's Bureau, part of the Administration for Children and Families. So that is the federal agency that oversees all of the agencies like DCS and those kind of things in our area. So then we have under education is going to be Mr. Fred Payne, who's the commissioner of the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. Now, one of the things that that resulted from COVID was the opportunity to do what the state calls reskilling and upskilling. So that is education. You're getting trained. You're getting retrained. You're getting trained to do something higher in your industry. And so I wanted to make families in our area more aware of that option and how it benefits families by taking advantage of that. Under health, we have Kimberly Roop. She is the president of Anthem Indiana Medicaid, and they are also a gold sponsor for this event this year. And what she's going to be discussing again is COVID. I mean, how it has impacted health delivery in general, healthcare delivery in general. What are some innovations or what are some things coming down the pipeline as a result of what we've seen going on with COVID, as well as some things that Anthem specifically offers to its clients with regards to helping them stay safe, especially how it works with families to ensure that the entire family is well taken care of. And then we have Nathan Ringham. He's the Director of Research and Insights with the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. And he's going to be discussing welfare and actually is really well-being, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that COVID impacted drastically was the economic well-being, not just of our country, but of our communities as well. And so he's here to talk about some of the avenues the state is looking down to generate economic development, not just statewide, but also region-wide, because each region has its strength. And so he's bringing that information in, letting us know what the outlook is, and then how families, again, can take advantage of that information and connect to it so that they can benefit from it as well. And then we're going to allow them, we're going to provide a little bit of a Q&A as well as the virtual environment lets us do that. I know this is kind of last minute. We haven't quite decided if we're going to do breakout sessions or just have a general Q&A, but it's looking more and more just like after they give their report, then the attendees can ask the panelists questions with regard to what they said. So wanted to make it interactive, wanted those folks to have an opportunity to hear from regular people to understand their concerns as they're learning how to live with COVID, you know. And so because there may be things that the public can share with them that they haven't considered, you know. And so that's something to I think that that's a benefit for them, too, and I think that was one of the reasons that they were willing to be a part of this. So.
We're talking with Janae Beleza, who is the COO of the Indiana Parenting Institute, which is based here in Northwest Indiana, and we're finding out more about the annual State of the Family Luncheon, which is coming up on November 16th. And I know that the idea is to bring together everybody's own individual thoughts and issues and views, I suppose, to deal with the health and well-being, because we know it isn't just one view or one handful of views. It's really a composite of a lot of decisions that a lot of people make every single day, isn't it?
Exactly. In fact, that was one of the things I was hoping I'd get a chance to remark upon, because I want the I want us as a community to start thinking about this, about how the lives that each one of us find ourselves living are a result of the composite of all the decisions that we have ever made, right? So the issue, though, is it's not the number of decisions that you've had to make to get to this point, but the quality of those decisions. Were they informed or were they ill-informed? And so if we want the kind of life that is pleasing to us, then it's important to ensure that we're doing what we need to do to get those informed decisions made, as opposed to making ill-informed decisions and kind of looking at our lives and going, how did I get here? And so that is a message that we want to get out to the public so that they can understand why it's important to go to events like this, because then they can go, okay, now I know what's going on and not hearsay, and then I can move forward and, you know, basically intelligently, because now I have right information versus, you know, somebody's opinion that may be an armchair quarterback. You know, and that's what I think that a push that's necessary in communities, especially those that are struggling, to go. Maybe part of the struggle is that we've gotten misinformed.
I know
we're making decisions based on misinformation.
I know there are always opportunities to learn, and I'm sure that, as in a lot of cases, and with the case in the past, I know, and with the State of the Family Luncheons, that those people who participate, in this case, you get a mobile app, because a lot of it, I know, is going to have to come that way for some.
Mm-hmm.
But also, too, that if you're a professional and you can do continued learning, that you have opportunities to pick up some CEUs, which are important, too, I know.
Right. So, if you do join us and you need CEUs, we do have 3 CEUs available. You just need to let us know that when you're registering that you are in need of those. And also, we do have an event app called Super Event that, as folks register and we get their contact information, we will get that app out to them so that they are able to have that interactivity that the event app provides. So I'm excited about that. It's our first journey with that. So I'm very interested to see how it will work. I've been at events and it's worked wonderfully. So, you know, new toys are always fun, right?
That's right. Now, if anybody is interested in attending and participating in the State of the Family Luncheon coming up here, how can they do so?
They would go to Eventbrite, and let me give you the name that it would be under.
Okay.
That's always the fun part.
Yeah.
I believe this year we have it under 2020 State of the Family Luncheon. So if they go to Eventbrite and look that up, that's what they'll see. I would give you the URL, but it's long.
Well, that's quite all right. If you just search for Eventbrite and you type in that particular event information, it'll send you right there. Yeah.
Yeah, 2020 State of the Family Luncheon is under. So.
While we only have a chance to talk today, Janae, I know that besides working with the Indiana Parenting Institute, you are also, I guess, now the chairperson of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Indiana Holiday Commission. And they have big events that come up. One big event in particular, they always have a big celebration for Dr. Martin Luther King Day. And there are opportunities that folks here in Northwest Indiana and organizations in the region can participate in this that apparently they never do. Tell us the thinking behind this and why you want more organizations in the region to get involved in this.
Well, as you said, we do a celebration at the state capitol every year. This year, I believe it's on the 13th of January. And there's awards given away at this. And they've really had a difficult time getting nominations from the 9 congressional districts that are represented by the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided that this year we're going to really make a push to make that happen, because usually what ends up happening is that the Indiana Civil Rights Commission, who serves as our administrative arm, usually has to bring, locate folks themselves. And sometimes they do get folks from other regions, but sometimes it's hard, you know, from other districts, but it's not the easiest thing to do. And that's part of the reason that we're there for. So this year we're really pushing out to get folks to go to the website and nominate folks.
Yeah.
So let me tell you a little bit about what we're looking for.
Yeah, tell us about these awards, please.
So I'm just going to, like, read the little blurb that they sent, that okay. the Civil Rights Commission sent me, so that because they say it better than I could. But so the 2021 commemorates the 30th annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Indiana holiday celebration at our state's capital. Do you know someone who has devoted their time, energy, heart, and soul into creating social justice? Someone who has influenced the breaking down of barriers? A person who has made endless contributions toward achieving the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we ask you to please nominate them. Nominate them now, in fact. The website is a little long, but I'll tell you, it gets you to our page, and okay. then you'll be able to see, once you get to our page, the link to get to where you nominate. But I'll give you, the commission's page is www.in.gov/MLKIHC.
Okay.
So that's the acronym for Martin Luther King Indiana Holiday Commission.
Okay.
And then the page number, because they do things by page numbers downstate, is 2385.htm,
right.
which will get you to the nominating page. But if you do www.in.gov/MLKIHC, then you'll be able to see the link to get to that.
Yeah, that just... That just opens up to the commission page, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. And then, like I said, there should be a link right there to get you to the nomination page. But for those who are a little bit more tech savvy than the rest of us, the actual page is, so after that MLKIHC, you would do /2385.htm.
Mm-hmm.
And the nominations close Friday, November 20th. So get those in. I would just love to be able to see some cool folk from our area get this award, because I know there's a lot of folk out there deserving of it. There's actually four awards that they're looking for nominations for, so it's not just one.
Okay.
There's the Freedom Award, which is granted to individuals or projects whose major societal influence includes breaking down barriers that have divided us in the past and or building ongoing relationships that foster respect, understanding, and harmony in our schools. Then there's the Chairman's Award, so I guess that covers me somehow, but
mm-hmm.
Presented at the chair's discretion, and I love you all, Northwest Indiana, so you got my discretion. It recognizes local projects, programs, initiatives, and or leaders that make significant contributions toward achieving the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King in the areas of economic development, poverty reductions, social justice, and or peacemaking efforts. The next award is a Trailblazer Award, and this recipient is the ultimate pillar of their community. Their efforts have afforded rights and liberties that did not exist previously. And then the final award is the Civil Rights Champion Award, which is presented by the Indiana Civil Rights Commission to recognize trailblazers who, inspired by Dr. King's dream, have devoted their personal and professional efforts to creating social justice in America and the state of Indiana. Those are all listed on that page when you go to nominate, but I just kind of wanted to give you an idea of who we're looking to honor and show them a sign of our gratitude and appreciation with these awards.
Well, there has to be some person or organization here in Northwest Indiana that's definitely deserving of one of these awards, and they
exactly.
ought to be nominated and get that nomination in here by November 20th, so we can mm-hmm. have somebody from Northwest Indiana to beat out all the other parts of the state of Indiana in getting these awards. Janae Beleza is the COO of the Indiana Parenting Institute, and in this particular capacity, she's chairperson of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Indiana Holiday Commission. They have some big awards coming up very soon, and we've got to get everybody from Northwest Indiana who's interested to participate in that. And Janae, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Chris. You have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. You too. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Carol Carlson referred to this earlier in our conversations today, but a reminder that the Gary Community School Corporation and the Gary Teachers Union have agreed to a new contract and will provide teachers with their first pay raise in more than 10 years, a 5.3% raise that was made possible by the referendum passage earlier this month. 60% of residents who voted in Gary, put them down yes for the referendum. And Gary Teachers Union President Gleneva Dunham says the union's members are very happy and very excited to receive a raise after such a long period of time. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Carol Carlson, reporter for the Post Tribune, to Burgess Peoples with the City of Gary Faith Leaders and Community Partnerships Organization, Jesse Carbonda with the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Indiana Parenting Institute Executive Jana Beleza for their participation in the program today. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you on Monday.